This is Build and Analyze, episode number 27. The show is a weekly news and discussion show about the world of iPhone, iPad, iOS, mobile web development. The hosts of the show are me, I'm Dan Benjamin, and of course, Marco Arment, who is the creator of Instapaper.com, which you should all be using. Shame on you if you don't. Today we'd like to say thanks to iStockPhoto.com and MailChimp.com for making the show possible. More on them as we get on with the show. And Marco, you're here. Big week next week for you, WWDC. What are you doing to prepare?
That's a good question. So I wrote a big tips post 2 years ago after the first time I went. Basically, because the first time I went, I was pretty poorly prepared because I really didn't know what to expect. One of the biggest things I have to do is I have to set up whichever laptop I'm going to take. I have to set it up so that it can sync to my phone and my iPad. And so I have to like move over whatever portion of my iTunes library I want to be on the phone, and you know, move it to the laptop and make everything sync, because chances are pretty good that, I mean, you probably don't want to go a week without being able to sync your phone a lot of places anyway. But I think especially at WWDC, it's very likely that there will be a beta of iOS 5 given to us the first day. Just the way that usually, I don't know anything about this, but the way they usually do things is like, you know, during the keynote, they will announce new iOS 5 and probably also a new Lion build as well. And I don't know, I'm not good enough at following the Mac side of things, so I don't know whether we should expect the GM of Lion here or not. They might certainly give us the GM build.
No, you're saying attendees will get this before even regular Apple developers.
I think it'll be posted on the Apple developer site for all developers.
Okay,
that's more likely, I think. And it's like, so Lion, they've been giving the Lion betas. I don't think this is under NDA. They've been giving the Lion betas through the App Store, and so it wouldn't surprise me.
Everybody knows about that,
right? And it wouldn't surprise me at all if the final version of Lion was actually distributed only through the App Store. Like, if you couldn't go buy a disc, or at least maybe it would be difficult, or you know, I don't know.
Here's a question: Will there be an upgrade path from Leopard or Tiger to, because if it, where is the App Store available? Is it available in Leopard or just Snow Leopard?
For any kind of system restore purposes, like if so, I have my MacBook Air came with Snow Leopard on that cool little USB thing. Well, this is a bad example, but let's say you have a new Mac that comes with Snow Leopard, and so you have the restore disks that come in the box. Normally, when there's a new OS version released, a new major version, you can take the CD from that version and use that as a restore disk on any previous Mac that came out before that was issued, and it'll work. So if you wanted to do a full restore for an older Mac, you could, for example, just put in the Snow Leopard CD, assuming the Mac came out before Snow Leopard, put in the DVD, and install straight from that. You don't have to install the restore disks that came with the laptop first and then upgrade. You can just do it straight from the new one. So I assume for reasons like that, there probably will, I guess, be a Lion disk. But anyway, it wouldn't surprise me if the GM and maybe even the final version was initially distributed through the App Store,
right,
or primarily distributed through the App Store. Anyway, so the reason you want to bring your laptop that can sync to your phone is that they're probably going to do the same thing with iOS 5. Where I'm guessing during the keynote, they'll say, here's how awesome iOS 5 is. And we got confirmation this morning that they are indeed, that Steve will be there, which is cool, and that they are indeed talking about iOS 5 and Lion.
Yeah, and iCloud and a whole bunch of other things.
Yeah, so, and we don't really know what iCloud is yet.
Cloud services offering.
Right. We can speculate, which I'm sure we will.
Yeah, we should. I was going to say,
we will, surely. But you know, we don't really know what it is yet. But anyway, what's going to happen is they're going to announce the stuff in the keynote. They're going to show off all the cool stuff in iOS 5 and Lion and presumably iCloud. And then at the end, they're probably going to say, and you know, iOS 5, we have a beta for developers starting today. And then it'll be available for everyone, like, who knows, September or something, July, who knows, whenever they release it. the impression I get from reading various Apple people's implications is that they are working their butts off to get this out on time, and that the whole schedule for iOS 5 has been fairly tight and compressed to get it out here for WWDC. So it's possible that it's not yet ready for a developer beta, but I think that's unlikely. I think chances are they'll give us a beta, even if it's not very usable. They'll polish up whatever they can and get it to us as a beta so we can start coding against all the new cool APIs they're going to tell us about.
I mean, I really feel like they who knows how things work internally at Apple unless you're there and those people don't talk about it. But you have to think that not shipping a beta of iOS 5, at least in Apple's eyes, whether the developer – you would think developers would care. But in from Apple's standpoint, not having that, not being able to hand that out when people get there or open the gates to download it, I think they would perceive that as a monumental failure if they couldn't do that, regardless of what the stakes are internally in the company.
Well, also just in the context of the conference, one of the reasons, as far as I know, Apple has not released the session schedule yet for the conference. But usually they release it a few weeks ahead of time. This is unusual. Usually it's a few weeks ahead of time, but they have a bunch of gaps that all just say to be announced. And usually whatever the cool secret new stuff is they announce during the keynote goes and fills in those gaps. So right after the keynote, they'll update the schedule and show you, oh, that's a session on this new API that they just announced. I don't know why we don't have a schedule yet. My best guess is that there are so many sessions about new things. This is major here. This is a new OS X release and a new iOS release. And a major iOS release, we think, at that. So there are probably tons of new APIs. And so I'm guessing the session schedule is like two-thirds things they can't tell us about yet. And so it's not particularly useful for them to release it yet.
Tell you what, this is the WWDC to go to.
Yeah, probably. This is going to be a good one, I think. So they have to give us the beta. I mean, they don't have to, but they really should give us the beta on Monday. That way, all these sessions that we're going to go to, we can actually try this code and run this code. You know, and that's going to be very important. Yeah. I think a lot of the value would be not necessarily lost, but just delayed, and you know, the enthusiasm would be reduced if we couldn't go try all the cool stuff they just told us about. I'm pretty sure we're going to have some kind of beta. They're going to have Ethernet ports set up everywhere, so you can plug in your laptop and download the file, not over wireless. The 4 gig SDK file.
Oh yeah, man.
They pipe the place up like crazy. So if you know the wireless might be slow during that keynote, but if you plug into an Ethernet port anywhere in the conference center, it's the fastest internet connection you will ever see. It's crazy. That's all basically what happened the last couple of years. I suspect the exact same thing is going to happen this year. And so far, all signs point to that being a pretty likely outcome. I would suggest at the conference that you bring a laptop that can run Xcode that you're comfortable developing on. So like the first year I went, I brought a first generation MacBook Air, and this was a mistake. And it was also inconvenient that they gave us the Snow Leopard preview DVD.
Right.
But I didn't have a DVD drive. So that was annoying. Because of the App Store distribution, I don't think that's going to be a problem this year. So I think I'm actually still kind of torn on whether I'm going to bring my Air or my 15-inch.
What are you leaning toward? The Air would seem perfect.
I think I'm going to bring the Air. This is the new generation Air, so it's a lot better than the old one. And it actually, at the moment, it has more space because it has the 256 drive. And in my 15-inch, I have a 160 gig Intel SSD. And that's the 15-inch has kind of become Tiff's laptop, so I think I'd rather just take the Air because it's kind of mine. But it was certainly tempting. And they have the same screen resolution too, so that also makes the decision easier. But it was certainly tempting to be like, you know, maybe I should take like the faster one, which is the 15-inch. And maybe I might need that DVD drive, but I really doubt it.
I mean, do you think that you're going to be – will you be writing a lot of code? In other words, you may want to sync up your phone, but are you going to be coding while you're there?
Um, probably not. You know, there's a certain level of denial that I have to get over here. I always think I'm going to do more actual coding work on trips and vacations than I actually end up doing. You know, the reality is...
Well, you're even planning on recording an episode of this show while you're there.
Yeah.
That's pretty brave.
Yeah. Well, that's only like an hour.
Right.
You know, the reality is every night I'm probably going to be out socializing with people. Now, last year they released the Safari SDK for extensions. And so I downloaded all the betas of that like during the session that they announced it in. And I basically started hacking away and coding. And I would code a beta extension that I was playing with during boring sessions. In reality, that's not really a good idea. Like, you really should be paying attention to the session. Like, that's why you're there. And maybe, like, you know, maybe if a session is boring, you should maybe dip out of it and go somewhere else.
Yeah. Do they allow that? Can you cut duck in and out of it?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And it's, I mean, it would be unfortunate if, like, half the room did it. But, you know, every session, a few people, you know, they go in, they realize that, because one thing, the sessions are usually pretty poorly titled. The titles are very rarely a good reflection of what they're going to be about. So, you know, it might be a very vague title, or the title might make it seem advanced when it's actually a very basic introduction, or vice versa. So it's very common for people to go in, realize they're in either a bad session or the wrong session for them, and then duck out and you know, go somewhere else. But yeah. Yeah, good point from David Smith in the chat room. That yeah, if you're going to bring an air like me, you got to bring a USB Ethernet adapter, because in previous years, and I assume it'll be the same this year. As I said, they make you wire up to wired Ethernet to download the big 4 gig SDKs, because they don't want everyone doing it over wireless.
How do they enforce that?
I'm sure there's just some cool networking trick they do where they just see which network you're on. I'm sure they're actually like different. I don't know if this is going to reveal my horrible knowledge of networking at this level, but I'm pretty sure they're on different subnets.
Maybe they block access from one.
Yeah, and it just shows like a redirect page if you access it from the wireless, saying, sorry, you got to go wire up, and here's the different locations.
So, they in other words, they enforce it with technology.
Yeah,
I was more curious, are they saying, please don't do it, or do they literally say, you're not allowed to do it?
No, they don't have people who like walk around...
I told you once, don't make me come back here.
I would also, you know, for the keynote line, this is important too. If this is your first year going.
Oh, the keynote line.
First of all, I love the keynote line coming from the East Coast, because the keynote starts at, it's 10 a.m. Pacific usually. Is it the same time this year?
Yeah, that's what the announcement did say, 10 a.m.
Okay, yeah, so it's 1 p.m. Eastern. It's 10 a.m. Pacific. And the great thing is, if you flew there from the East Coast the night before, you're gonna have a hard time staying awake very late that night. And so usually, like, I crash hard at like 10 o'clock at night, but like local time when I get there, which is great. So then I can easily wake up at like 6 a.m. and you know, go over to the keynote line. And no matter what time you get on the keynote line, it's going to be huge, and you're gonna think you're not gonna get in.
Right.
The keynote room does not hold everybody. It holds almost everybody, and there's like overflow rooms where you can go watch the keynote on a monitor if you don't get into the main room. But you know, if you get there, I think anytime before like 9 or maybe 8:30, get there before then, you should get into the main room. You probably won't get a good seat, but it's like a mad rush. Like they bring you through the whole building, and then you get up top. When you're about to go in the room, and then there's like the section where everyone kind of just runs across a giant hall, and then like, so like the line is fluid. So you don't need to get there like at 5 a.m. or anything. Usually I try to wake up sometime around 6-ish and go. I always go and get coffee. There's a Pete's down the street that's always open early. There's a Blue Bottle that's around the corner from Moscone that's really good, but the line is always very long. I don't know if they're open that early. So Blue Bottle is better, but it takes longer. Anyway, yeah, so...
Would this be the right time to bring a Starbucks Via with you?
Actually, it's worth having them for the plane ride there and
is
back.
Is it Via or Via?
I don't know. It's a Latin word, and nobody knows how to pronounce Latin.
Okay.
Everyone just guesses, because we don't really have any references. I took Latin in high school. I know none of it. But I can tell you that no pronunciation of a Latin word is authoritative because no one really knows what they said it. So everyone's just guessing. And if, I think it just became everyone just assumes that Latin sounds kind of British because of all the British movies like I, Claudius. And but anyway, yeah, so get on the keynote line fairly early if you want to see the stage somewhat reasonably. I would also suggest installing a marquee app on your iPad. Because have you ever seen these marquee apps?
No, what are those?
It's a very simple app, and it just shows, you know, just like you type in text, and it'll scroll across the screen in huge letters like a marquee. Am I pronouncing that right? Is it marquee?
Marquee, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
You're talking about, so you can put some, and it's like a marquee, like a billboard.
Yeah, exactly.
With letters and words scrolling across it, like a stock ticker.
There's like two times a year where this is useful to have on your iPad. It's a nice little novelty, but the WWDC keynote audience arena is one of those places where everyone holds up their iPad with this thing and shows funny messages while we're all waiting for the thing to start.
So it's like a social game.
Yeah, it's just like a cultural thing. Yeah, I have an app. I remember I had a hard time finding the right one.
Now, what do you recommend?
The app I have is just called Marquee, and the icon is navy blue background with a giant red M and half of an A. So anyway, we'll link in the show notes. I'll try to find it. I think it was $1 or $2. Doesn't really matter.
I have the same, very same app.
Oh, good. Okay. So yeah, you know, and I mean, really the interface for it is terrible. It's way too complicated. Like it takes so long the first time you start it to figure out where do I just start typing and hit play? Because it tries to do so much. It tries to have all these deluxe features and everything. But it's anyway, install that on your iPad before the keynote and don't expect any kind of internet connectivity in the keynote room because you won't have it. We all knew last year with Steve yelling at everyone to turn off the MiFis. Right. That was really awkward, by the way. That was like painful sitting there watching Steve Jobs stop his entire presentation and yell at everyone to turn these things off.
Like as I'm sure one day soon you will probably know when you decide to have kids, it's very much a parent thing. Put your fork down. Don't make me tell you again. Put your fork down. Put exactly. It down. And then the next day, I told you yesterday, please put your fork down. And it's like by the fifth time, the fifth day of reminding your kid, you know, kid not to bang the fork or whatever, you're just, you're over it. Exactly. And that's how it seemed. It seemed like he's just, I shouldn't have to tell you people this.
Yeah.
Well, how are we supposed to live blog if he tells us not to use our wine?
And the fact is, even like the previous, so this is going to be my third year going. So last year was MiFi hell. The previous year, 2009, I actually had, I think I had some kind of Verizon. I think back then it was still a USB modem. I had a Verizon EVDO modem back then, and I also had my AT&T iPhone. Even back then, when the room wasn't full of MiFis, everyone was offline. Like you couldn't. Everyone was like holding up their phone. Their phone's batteries were slaughtering themselves trying to amp up their power. The fact is, it's way too many people in a very small space, all trying to use a data connection, and there just aren't enough data channels like in the radio space to do that kind of density. At least there weren't in 2009. And so any carrier you have, everyone says, "Oh well, maybe I'll bring my Sprint phone or something." Every right. carrier you have, trust me. Enough other people have had that idea and are trying the exact same thing in that room that you should just assume that you're going to have no connection in that entire room. If you are going to try, I suggest bringing a lot of extra batteries for your thing.
That's what I was going to ask.
You're going to sit online before the keynote for 3 hours and be bored out of your mind. So everyone is going to be using their battery-powered devices for 3 hours first. Then you're going to go into the keynote and try to get a signal in a room where the device can't. So it's going to crank its power up and it's going to kill its battery. And so like everyone, like usually by the time you're in that room, like once the keynote starts, half of people's phones are dead.
Mm.
Even considering that, you still can't get a connection. So just don't even bother trying to live block it. Just go and enjoy it. You know, just sit there and watch and appreciate that, you know, if you're like me and you are, if this stuff is meaningful to you, appreciate that you're actually here seeing this cool thing live and these cool people showing off this cool stuff And this is like, you know, in our little world, this is a moment of history. And, you know, so just enjoy it. You can take a few pictures if you want. They're going to suck. You're not going to be in a good spot to take right. pictures from. So just enjoy it. Just sit back and enjoy it.
Yeah, I mean, for a lot of people, it really is, I don't want to say once in a lifetime, but it's certainly a unique experience. It's not something you will do frequently. If you're lucky enough to go to WWDC every year, maybe you can take advantage of that, but just enjoy it. Enjoy the moment.
Exactly. Also, one more thing before I forget. On that laptop that you're going to bring, that you've configured to sync to your iPhone and iPad, don't forget to also transfer your Xcode build identities. And Xcode makes this really, really easy. I don't know where it is in Xcode 4, which I'll talk about in a second, but in Xcode 3 in the organizer window, there was in fairly recent versions, they added like an export developer identity, an import developer identity, so it would just export like one file that contained all your certificates and profiles and all that stuff. So that way, if you're setting up a new computer to do development on, you don't have to mess with all that crap in Keychain and getting all the profiles right. You just save this one file from your first computer and, you know, stick it on your second one and import it, and you're all set. So yeah, definitely configure all the certificates and everything, and actually, you know, do a build from the thing. And so here's one other thing too. If you know, I said earlier that I'm always in denial that I never actually get as much coding work done as I think I will. But there's the labs, and this is important. So the WWDC labs are, and we've talked about this before when we talked about the conference when the tickets went on sale. But basically, in a short recap, the labs are this big cafeteria where they set up little areas full of computers, and they're all staffed by Apple engineers, and they're designated for, like, this is the UI kit lab, this is the, you know, scroll view lab, this will be the in-app purchase lab, this will be Game Center. So at certain times and certain places you can go, and you can actually talk to the Apple engineers who work on that thing, at least some of them. And oftentimes you're talking to the person who wrote the component that is on the banner on top of you. And so what's great about this is that if you are having a problem in your code with one of these components, or if you have a question, or if you have a really you know, reasonable feature request, you can go and talk to the actual people who wrote this or who are writing it, and they can tell you, you know, oh, behind the scenes it's doing this, this, and this, and that's why this bug shows up, and this is how you can get around it. Or they can listen to your feedback, and or they can help you, and they're like, oh, you didn't set this property, and that's, you know, they've seen all these problems a million times, so they know it really well. So the labs are a pretty good reason to bring something that can run live code on your device, that can make the builds, and so somewhere where you can do light editing. It's a good idea to bring questions to the labs. Like, you know, make a list over the next few days before you fly out there. Like, you know, has anything really bothered you or puzzled you about some interface component that you don't really know why it does the thing it does, or like you keep seeing this one bug and you can't figure it out? Like, write all those down and bring those questions with you and save them for the labs, because it's really, you know, this is your once a year chance to talk to these engineers. There's never any other way to do this. You can open up developer support incidents, but those are limited and expensive, and it's not really, you're not talking to them in person, and, you know, this is the one place where you can kind of have like a casual conversation with these engineers who work there. So that's yet another reason to bring something that you can code on, even if you don't intend to do a lot of coding.
This episode is sponsored by iStockPhoto.com, the world's original source for affordable, user-generated, royalty-free stock images, media, and design elements. So whether you're a designer, a blogger, an advertiser, entrepreneur, they've got over 8 million high-quality photos, illustrations, and clips you can use to tell your story. They've also got the most robust search tool in the business, and I should know, I've used their stuff for tons of websites that I've made, and it's super easy to find just the right thing you're looking for. And these guys are the real deal. I mean, they've got the highest quality independent content and two premium collections, Veta and Agency, and they've got a brand new editorial collection too. So as a 5x5 listener, if you go there and sign up for a free account, you'll get a 10% discount on 50 or more iStock credits to buy and download images, video, and audio. Go to iStockPhoto.com/5x5 for details. Now, this offer expires at the end of July, July 30th. So go there and check it out. Say anything with iStock, iStockPhoto.com.
I've been sitting on this Xcode 4 topic for months. It's been like at
the
bottom
of the
list
forever. Can we talk about Xcode 4? Is it legal?
I think is it the current shipping version?
I'll go check while
you know what?
Break the NDA. I'll go check.
Okay. What made me think of doing this now, first of all, is it's relevant because this is WWDC, although I guess this is always a development podcast in theory, so I guess it's kind of always relevant. But the last episode of Core Intuition, the podcast with Daniel Jalkut and Matt and Reese, talked a lot.
To Mac and iOS developers.
It's very, very relevant. And I think, so overall, so I waited until after I shipped 3.0 to Switch. And I have Switch now. The reason I waited is because it's really, really different. And it's not a good idea to start switching up your tools right in the middle of a major release, like right before you're about to ship something. That's not good. So, you know, wait until you have a kind of a quiet period where maybe like you're about to start a new major version or a new major branch. You know, that's a good time to start switching up the tools and trying out new things. So there's a lot about Xcode 4 that I like, and there's a lot that I don't. For the most part, I think it's fairly obvious that Apple themselves, and they mentioned this in Core Intuition, right? Wow. All right, so they mentioned it in Core Intuition. I don't think Apple is requiring their own engineers to use this yet, or at least full time. And you can kind of tell. Like, there's a lot of things that don't really work quite right. The interface, I think, is in many ways actually less intuitive. It's also just very buggy, especially the interface builder type windows. It's very buggy. It's not. There's a lot of things that are different in good ways. A lot of things are different in bad ways. Overall, I think it's a net improvement, but it's going to take a while for it to become mature. I do like the single window goal of it. You know, I mean, you can make multiple windows, you can open up new windows, but it's like you can keep everything in that one window if you want. I like that because it actually makes better use of the space on laptops and even just like I recently switched from my desktop. I switched away from dual 24-inch monitors. And I switched to a single 30-inch monitor.
Wow.
And I love it. Like, dual monitors for me always felt kind of hacky. Like, I never really used the space on the secondary monitor very well. Most of it just went to waste. The field of view had to be very wide to see it all, and it seemed like it was encouraging me to just have more window clutter open, instead of just making me deal with that in a better way. And you know, it seemed more distracting, and it didn't fit me very well. What the?
What is that? I thought you said you didn't have a phone. Well, is that your old, like, Bell, like, ancient Bell phone, like a 1950s?
Yeah, it's my mom's old phone from Brooklyn. Back when Brooklyn was still the 212 area code, because it has a little card in it that says that. sorry.
I think this is great. I'm not taking any of this out.
That's good. Yeah, that's the Verizon Fios phone line that I kind of regret getting, because the only people who call it are Verizon to spam me for more offers with more services. So anyway, the 30-inch monitor fits me better. You know, just having the one big one, it's just a lot for me. It's easy for me to focus. My desk is a lot cleaner and a lot simpler setup. Importantly, I can now have my speakers evenly spaced on the desk. Like, previously, like, the setup was so wide that the right side speaker would be like really, really far away compared to the left side speaker, and so it didn't sound that good. But I know that that's very important to a lot of people. So so Xcode 4, it works better on individual screens, great for laptops, etc. I also like Instruments a lot in the new one. For some reason, Instruments in Xcode 3 was always very buggy for me to launch. Like, it never quite attached properly to the processes reliably. It was very confusing for me to, you know, how to launch certain tests to actually work. It seems like it's a lot better in Xcode 4. Documentation, I think, took a bit of a step backwards. I mean, there's lots of places in the UI where they try to cram things into the single window setup that really shouldn't be. Like, I don't like how the find and like the find results window is kind of shoved into the side where all the folders should go. Like, it's just a little weird, like how much they shove into that bar, and it doesn't really fit in a lot of ways. But overall, I'm getting into it now. I'm getting used to it, and you know, it's not really getting in my way too much. And I think it's important too to mention. We mentioned this back in a previous episode. I think it was. Let's see where. It was sometime in April. I lost it already. Anyway, we talked in a previous episode about. Oh, it was the Dick Bar episode.
Ah, right.
We talked about how it's fairly futile to hold on to old versions of apps. You know, you can say, "Oh, I'm going to stick with Xcode 3 forever." So normally, you can't really hold on to old versions for very long because at some point they stop working, or the new version has something really compelling that is only the new version that you really want to use. And especially in this world, it wouldn't surprise me if Apple says the only version of Xcode that is usable with iOS 5 development is Xcode 4. At some point, Apple's going to make that transition, and they're going to say Xcode 3 can no longer build for this OS, or it can no longer build for App Store submissions or something. Like, at some point, they're going to effectively force this change on us. And it probably isn't that far off. I mean, I would say Xcode 4 is usable enough now that they could do that. They might wait another major version or something, but I think for the most part, they're going to do that fairly soon. So at some point, this change is going to be forced on you, whether you want it or not. And so you might as well do it, like find a convenient time now to do it and do it then. So now, like if I was holding on to 3 forever, and then iOS 5 comes out, and then they say, "Oh, you're required to use Xcode 4." What if that's a really terrible time for me to switch? What if I'm like about to ship 3.0,
yeah,
and all of a sudden I need to switch my entire development environment and learn all these new things, and it's going to slow me down and everything? So it's much better to do it when you control when you do it. So do it when you still have time, when they haven't forced transition yet. So that way, when they do force it, you're already there. And in the meantime, it hasn't come at some horrible time for you. So, yeah, I don't love it, but it's good enough for now. It's good enough for me not to want to go back to Xcode 3 because I know I'll just be holding on to this dinosaur that is going to be probably killed very soon. So it's just not worth the risk of having it be killed at a time that's inconvenient, really, or risky.
You know, downtime, I mean, a lot of developers are probably thinking, well, I don't have that much downtime, but you definitely don't want to try to be figuring this stuff out while you're trying to upgrade to the next. You know what I'm saying? It's all going to pile up at once. You want to spread it down. You get enough to worry about as a developer with the new API changes and everything that's going to come out. How's Apple about deprecating things?
Deprecating APIs, they're very good at. I mean, they'll keep around deprecated APIs for a very long time. But I think in the iOS world and possibly even in the modern Mac development world, I think they're being a lot more aggressive with their schedules of just pushing the new version. Like, this new version is it. That's what we're doing. Like, iOS 5, I've heard rumors that it doesn't even run on the 3GS. And that's a phone they still sell. But I don't know if that's true. But, like, you know, even when iOS 4 came out last year, iOS 4 it ran very badly on 3G. But the 3G was being sold until iOS 4 came out. Like, they had the 3GS, but they were also still selling the 3G as the cheap one. And so, like, this year, it's, you know, suppose that iOS 5 runs on the 3GS, but very, very badly. They're still selling those. They're still selling quite a lot of them, actually.
Yeah. And they're cheaper, aren't they? Like $49 now?
Something like that, or maybe different carriers. I guess they're only AT&T. Yeah, something like that. There's some deal where they're really cheap. It doesn't really matter. I mean, your first month of service is going to cost more than that. So who cares? I guess it probably does matter to somebody. But yeah, I just think, like, you know, if a phone costs $50 or $100, but it requires you to spend like $80 a month on its plan, does it really matter whether it costs $50 or $100 the front when you first bought it?
Yeah.
Apple's very aggressive about pushing things forward. So again, it wouldn't surprise me at all if they became even more so in with iOS and with recent things, and they have all this big stuff. They have Xcode 4. They have the App Store. Like you and John Gruber were speculating on the last talk show about how they could. Oh, what was it, Gruber or Syracuse? You're saying how you could Apple could start requiring all apps to be from the App Store and just have a checkbox somewhere to turn that off to help combat malware.
Right, and that was part of the whole discussion about this. The most recent bout of malware issues were. If there was no way to download apps by default, or you could download them but couldn't install them or do anything productive with them, except through the App Store, that would eliminate that risk completely. And the point that was made was it's worked pretty well on iOS. And if you're an expert user and you want to, you know, it almost follows in a way the Android model, and that was what we were talking about on the show. And I'm actually having, with everything that I've been going through the last week or two, I can't keep anything straight. And I forget whether it was Hypercritical with John Syracuse or the talk show with Gruber.
It was Gruber.
It was Gruber. Okay. And on the Android side of the house, if you want to install apps from other sources, instead of having to like jailbreak your phone, you just check a little box that says, I'm cool with this. And wouldn't it be great if macOS had a similar box you could check that by default, all apps would come through the App Store, and if you were an expert user, advanced user, you at your own risk type thing, go and uncheck the box and you install them the way you've always wanted to. But for people who are, you know, maybe not experts and who maybe aren't really wanting to get apps from other sources anyway, they wouldn't have to do that.
Exactly. And by the way, if Apple is going to make a move like this, this would be the time to do it for Lion.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't think that would be unreasonable. I think that would be perfectly fine if they did the exact same thing like what Android has, where there's some checkbox buried in settings somewhere that says allow apps from other sources, and you know, Adobe and Microsoft can instruct their users to do that. And for the most part, it's not going to get in most people's way after that. And maybe it'd be the kind of thing where, like, you can turn it on. Maybe it's like an allow thing where you turn it on to allow this app to install, but it doesn't stay on forever.
Right.
You know, something like that.
Yeah.
So you could install Office and Photoshop and then turn it off.
Right.
I'd probably do that too. Just
I would. You know, the last I would just for the peace of mind. Sure.
Right.
How often are you installing these days? How often are you installing? I mean, I'm sure there are people who install a new app every day because they like to mess around. But if you're like a productive developer, software engineer, you pretty much get things set up once and then you're good to go until there's, you know, an update.
Oh, yeah.
And I would love it if all of the apps that I used were available on the App Store. I prefer that. I don't want to have to remember the websites of all the different apps to go. It's the same thing. You know, where'd you get this cool app on your phone? Well, duh, the App Store. Where else? Just go in there and search for it. You know, it's nice to be able to tell somebody the name of an app, and they just know all I have to do is go to the App Store and search, and there it is.
Exactly. I mean, we've had that luxury in iOS. It's been awesome for everyone, for developers, for users. It's really been great. I mean, I think I would love it if Apple did that. Honestly, I think it'd be a very good idea to do that now for Lion, because I mean, when does 10.8 come out? You know, 3 years from now, 2 years from now, might as well do it now. This is the perfect time, and it's also well timed with that Mac Defender thing, because if any of that bad press is for some reason still around in a week, Apple can very quickly squash it by saying, look, Lion is a lot more secure because
right.
of this little change that we're making. And it's going to annoy a few people, but it's not like it'd be different if they said
you can't even run.
I think Adobe and Microsoft are the big reasons why they really can't do that on the desktop. It's just too much of a history there and too many people who depend on those apps. I mean, they sell a lot of copies of Office for Mac.
Well, now you can get it through that Amazon store.
Yeah, right. The Mac download store.
Mac download store.
Oh, boy. So many app stores. I tweeted this one. I get emails like twice a week from somebody who's launching a new app store for some platform and they want me to port Instahaper to their platform, or they want me to list it in their store. And, oh my God, we really don't need any more app stores. Really, we have plenty of app stores. If there's a million different app stores, the value of them goes away.
So why does Microsoft put Office for Mac on the Amazon App Store as opposed to in the Apple App Store? Or was it, you know, was there some something that happened without their control? They had to approve that, right?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if it could go on the Apple App Store. It probably needs like root access to install things and stuff like that. So it probably does, or maybe it calls undocumented APIs to get certain things to work. My best guess is that neither Adobe's major products nor Microsoft Office would be approved to the App Store under the rules, technically. I mean, and if Apple made an exception for them, I don't think anybody would really complain meaningfully. But, you know, there's probably a lot of technical reasons. Like, App Store installs can't run, like, this big installer package that changes things and everything. Like, the install process is just like a file copy, basically. So if your app is something like Photoshop or Office, it has to do crazy things like, you know, install system fonts and do all this crazy stuff. It probably can't work in the technical architecture of the Apple App Store, even if they permitted it. But anyway, I think that install App Store only apps checkbox is definitely in our future. The question is when. And it wouldn't surprise me if they kind of rushed it and tacked it onto line at the last minute.
Yeah, I think that'd be just such a great feature. Tell your parents to just check that.
Right, and exactly.
Never get those calls again.
Oh yeah. And somebody in the chat room, Arrogant in the chat room, said it'd be nice if it just prompted you. You know, this app isn't from the Apple App Store. Do you want to install it? And I think it has to be a little bit harder than that. I think even though this is un-Apple-like, I think the box that pops up would have to say something like, this app isn't from the App Store. Change blah, blah, blah in settings to enable these apps to install. It can't, like, there can't be a button that just says allow, because then it's no safer than like the way Windows does everything, where Windows just yells at you constantly saying, hey, this thing that's about to happen might not be secure. Allow it. And everyone just gets used to just clicking yes and typing in their password and just clicking yes a million times, because they have to do that so often, it loses its effectiveness and people don't really read.
Right.
Whereas if you are a novice enough user that you probably shouldn't be installing unsupported apps because you're more of like a malware and virus target risk, then you might never go and find that setting that allows you to change that. Even if the box tells you this setting exists, A, you probably didn't read what the box said, and B, you probably can't find it. And so that, I think, is a case where you have to be a little bit obtuse. Like, you have to inconvenience the user to make sure, like, you can change this if you really want to. If you understand what this means, you can change this. But they can't make it too easy.
Speaking of making things easy, let's talk about our second sponsor. It's MailChimp.com. These guys help you design email newsletters, share them on social networks, integrate with services you already use, and track your results. It's like your own personal publishing platform, and it's free for up to 2,000 subscribers and 12,000 emails a month. Now, I use a ton of MailChimp services, so every time their sponsorship comes up, I try and think of something different to tell them about. We've told them about, you know, a Chimp Kit and Chimp Bot. But today I was thinking we could talk about MailChimp Mobile. So here's the thing. If you're always on the go, it's likely that your subscribers probably are too. And MailChimp makes it really easy to make email newsletters for people who are not necessarily on their computers, but who are on mobile devices, from Blackberries to iPads, whatever it is. Managing your account on a smartphone, API wrappers. And what they've done is they've created a whole guide that explains how to use and integrate these features in a really nice way. You can go to MailChimp.com and click the resources link right there and find out more. But these are really, really nicely made PDF guides that walk you through everything, whether you're just a person making the mail list or a developer and you want to integrate it in your app. So go check it out, MailChimp.com. Great sponsor.
Yeah, they're great. So how about this Google API shutdown thing?
Yeah, I mean, this is big news. This is just... This is if you follow the Hacker News, news.ycombinator.com, those guys had a field day with this. There was an article on there entitled would you ever use a Google API ever again? So maybe can you give the backstory on this? How did this happen? What's the story?
I actually know not much about it. Basically, Google posted last week basically that something like 17 APIs are being deprecated. Out of that, like 7 or 8 of them are being totally shut down at some point fairly soon. One of those is the Translate API. And this is like most of them are APIs that most people probably wouldn't have been using. The Translate API was pretty popular though, and it was literally just, you know, you send a text and a source and destination language pair, if even that, I think it could auto detect it, and then it gives you back a machine translation. And it wasn't a very good translation, but it was workable. So a lot of apps, I mean, all over the web, everything was using this for lots of things. Like you could provide a crappy version of your site in another language if you wanted to. But one of the big uses for it was iPhone and presumably Android translation apps. When I went to Germany this past January, and I was looking at all these translation apps, and almost all of them were just wrappers around this API. So it's very, very popular, and you could tell. I blogged about this too. Like you can tell that an app that uses this API, it'll only do machine translations. They kind of suck, and it won't work offline because it's just calling this API, which is inconvenient if you are traveling internationally and don't use the extremely expensive data roaming plans. So on one side, I was kind of happy that they announced this. So I was thinking maybe all these crappy apps will die out and people will actually be able to develop and find a good version that actually works offline and uses maybe a better translation engine. But turns out there's a Bing API that does exactly the same thing, and it's still free. So I'm assuming that apps are all going to just switch to the Bing API if they haven't already. So it's not, the apps aren't really going anywhere. But the bigger story here is that, you know, Google was telling everyone, hey, here's our APIs, use them. And then they go and shut down a lot of them. And I think it's easy to yell at Google and call them evil and all this stuff and say, oh, I'm never going to trust them again. But the reality is these are third-party services that you don't control. They have their own needs and their own goals, and you can never depend on an API being there forever unless it's yours. And even then, you might want to change something or deprecate it or rewrite the whole thing completely in 10 years. Like, so it's, you shouldn't base your business so heavily on something on a web API that you don't control. It might work for a while, but the fact is, so Google is killing this API. They're giving, the shutdown date is December, something in December this year. And that's not really that far away. So sometime in the next 6 months, everyone who's using this API has to either stop and just shut down or switch to the Bing API, and hopefully it provides the same capabilities, whatever capabilities you were using, and hopefully Microsoft keeps that open and free forever.
Yeah.
But even that's probably not going to happen. So I think it's just the reality of the internet world is that it changes a lot. APIs change, services change, everything is always changing. You can't depend on anything staying constant. But if your biggest dependencies are on yourself and things that you control, you're certainly on more solid ground. And so I think if you are ever going to do something with a third-party service like this, it should be something that you can easily replace if you need to in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And a machine translation API is pretty hard to replicate. And this is not something you can easily replace. So, and again, this is very relevant to our previous discussions about Twitter, because Twitter is another huge API that is not easily replaceable, that is out of your control. And so if you're building an entire business on Twitter, it might work. It certainly might work for a while, but it's not going to be permanent. And I mean, that being said, the App Store is not technically an API, but the App Store is the big platform that I don't control. And my product is totally at the whims of Apple. Like they, if Apple wanted to remove my product from the App Store, they would kill my entire business right there. That's it. I recognize this. This is a major risky dependency. And I'm not comfortable with it at all. But I recognize, you know, that's a very real risk that could happen.
Yeah. I mean, it very much is a privilege. And people, I think, don't think of it that way. Maybe the same way that they don't think of driving as a privilege. Most people, if you were to ask, I'm not saying most people in our listeners, I'm saying if you were to walk the streets of your local town and say, is driving a right or a privilege? Most people feel like it's a right, or they might understand that it's a privilege, but they feel like it's a right.
Exactly.
And it's certainly not. Driving is a privilege, and having your app in the App Store is very much a privilege. And it does kind of suck to think that you could have a business that's successful and then for some reason it gets pulled or you're blocked. I mean, there's so many stories we hear of developers whose apps are getting turned down. We don't hear as much about apps that are already in existence that get removed. But in the world of API, I mean, you're always used to APIs getting deprecated in some way. But having this happen, especially with such a big public company, wow.
Yeah. And the reason they cited was extensive abuse. That could mean anything. It also could be complete crap. I mean, that could just be false. But yeah, I mean, whatever the reason, like Google is not operating these APIs as a charity to society. You know, like they're not doing this for good. Like they're doing this for some reason. There's always a reason. It might be overall good nature. Like, oh, we want to make it better for our products, or something. You know, like there's always a reason where someone is. To quote Merlin, like everyone has their reasons. Everyone's doing something for a reason. I love that. And, it's easy for people to see other companies and other people as these like anti-personal, just like these machines that are just evil at heart and everything. And that's not the case. I mean, everyone does things usually for good, understandable reasons. And
right.
You can often look at, you know, if you were in that position, would you have made the same decision? And often the answer is yes. So, you know, you can't really blame Google for this, but the fact is, like, you can't depend on an API forever because there are all these, like, nothing exists in a vacuum, nothing is permanent. Like, there's this whole environment around these things. An API is run by a big company with big costs behind it, pressures from inside and outside to change things from where they are now. So that's it. I mean, you can't really depend. And also, like, look at the news came out, I think, yesterday that I guess Twitter is about to launch a photo hosting service.
Right. Very interesting, because just last week you were talking about why you decided not to do that at the time.
Exactly.
During your tenure at Tumblr.
And did I mention last week that this is the kind of thing that if Twitter wanted to do it, they would have to have their own client? Or rather, they would be better off if they had their own client? This is one of the reasons why Twitter has to control the clients. Why it's totally understandable for them to first to have bought Tweety, and now to be discouraging people from using other clients and discouraging people from developing them. Because Twitter needs to innovate its features. And I did mention this, that you know, if Twitter launches a new feature and none of the big apps support it, either because they don't care or because they have business reasons not to, then Twitter's screwed. Their hands are tied. So they had to own the client experience so that they can launch new features and do what they want to do with their network and their product without relying on all these developers to charitably integrate these features. So Twitter has to have a photo posting service. They just have to. It's amazing it's taken them this long to do it. That's what I was thinking.
I mean,
because so many people use Twitter to post photos.
So many people use it. It's one of those things that there's basically two things that you have to think of when you think of I guess, add-ons to Twitter. And one of them is URL shortening, and the other is photo sharing.
Exactly.
You've got to think of those. And it's so weird. Is it? So let me ask you, somebody who contemplated implementing this on a large scale, is it that, I mean, we talked about this a little last week, but is it that hard? Is it so hard that Twitter couldn't do it?
No, it's extremely easy. It's expensive. That's it. It's like the architectural needs for it are very, very simple. You just have to have a lot of storage and bandwidth. And the fact is you can use pretty much any either you can use a cloud service like S3, or you can use like an in-house thing that you run on your own hardware, like what Twitter is presumably going to do and what Flickr does. But there's not a lot of interconnected data necessary for this. You don't have to it can be like a very kind of key value storage kind of access. So it's very easy to scale that out and make it very big and very fast. So it's just an issue of just funding it. You know, storage and bandwidth are both not cheap, or rather they're not free. They are actually pretty cheap, but they're not free. So you know, that's why the experience now with these photo sharing services is horrible. Like you never really know which service is going to badly compress your image. You never know when people click on it what they're going to see. Are they going to be surrounded by a bunch of ads, and is that going to change in the future? What are they going to do with your images? Like in the case of TwitPic, with that crazy new terms of service where they own your images and no one can use them without buying a license from this company. I mean, that's like all this stuff. Twitter has to do this. They have to, because this is a major portion of their feature set that so far has been completely out of their control. And that terms of service change on TwitPic, I think, kind of kicked their butt a little bit. If they weren't thinking about this by then, which they probably were by then, but I think that kicked their butt a little bit into releasing this like ASAP, because they realized how vulnerable they were on that front. And it's also just, it's a very confusing user experience for people who are new to Twitter, especially non-geeks, who say, all right, how do I post a photo? And it's like, well, you have to choose TwitPic or YFrog. Like, what does that mean? What? Like, it's just very, very confusing. So yeah. They have to add this. And I'm very glad, assuming that these reports were true, I'm very glad they are adding it. And I can't wait. So, I mean, they just had to. I got a great question from Keith Selby a couple weeks ago.
Mm.
I know you say that as though you've been expecting this forever.
Yeah. When is Marco going to get to the Keith Selby email?
Exactly. And he said, how do you handle Android? I'm pretty sure Marco's answer is that he doesn't. That's correct. However, as a mobile contractor, I can no longer ignore that platform. I can no longer have a viable mobile business focusing exclusively on iOS. All right, so how do I handle this? First, a giant disclaimer, as usual. I'm not a contractor. I don't know the business very well. I only have my one product, and that's it. I've never done client work in mobile at all. But I think it's important to ask, so he says, as a contractor, I can no longer ignore that platform. Is that based on assumptions, or is that actually based on client demand? And that's important to distinguish. I mean, it probably is based on client demand. I mean, Android's big enough now that everyone's probably going to be asking for having both. But make sure you ask yourself, are you just assuming that you have to do this, or do you actually have to do it? So assuming you actually have to do it, another question is Android going to be profitable for you? Because it might be. I mean, certainly if clients are just paying you to make it and they are taking all the financial risk, then it's probably worth your while. But if you're relying on an upside, like a portion of the app sales, or if you're making your own products for Android, you have to try to figure it's going to cost me X to have an Android version over my iOS version. Am I going to make enough to cover that cost based only on Android sales? And again, it's going to vary. Some people, they can say yes. Some people, they can't say that. And the other thing is, this is obviously something that he doesn't really want to do because he's kind of reluctantly.
Yeah, a lot of reluctance there, yeah.
Yeah. And this is a big problem from what I understand in all the client industries. Client service industries where the client is asking you to do something that you don't like doing. And do you do it? Do you just suck it up? Do you say, no, I don't do that and reduce your business, but benefit yourself and your sanity? Who knows? I mean, if somebody's asking you to develop on Android and you don't really want to, can your business actually continue if you just say no and you just stick to what you like doing? The answer might be yes. It wouldn't surprise me at all if it was yes. And are you okay with that? Like, are you would you rather take more money and more business at the expense of your own happiness? Like, is the money in business what gives you the happiness, or is the developing for the platform you like giving you the happiness? So, you know, all things to think about. I think it's funny, like, to me, Android development for people who like developing for iOS, I think it's like the modern day IE compatibility.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like that thing that all of us, like designers and developers, really don't want to deal with, and
right.
it's a pain in the butt, and it's a lot of additional work.
And you can almost choose to just ignore it at
right.
You know,
some people can just ignore it,
and other people they can't.
But yeah, like if you're doing client services, they're going to want the biggest compatibility than most people, and so you probably can't ignore it on that scale. But what's interesting this time is, what about other smaller platforms? Like, what about WebOS? WebOS is a major smartphone platform.
Right.
Windows Mobile 7 series, whatever it's called, is also a major mobile platform. These are both major platforms that don't have a lot of users. Hey, what about BlackBerry, by the way? That's a really big mobile platform that has lots of users that he didn't mention. You know, if he says are clients not demanding BlackBerry apps? If so, that's interesting, first of all.
Yeah.
But, you know, BlackBerry is really big. It's, I don't know what the installed bases are like today, but I think the overall installed base, not just new unit sales, I think BlackBerry and Android are pretty close to each other.
But it's clear that you could do nothing but an iOS app and make a great living and completely ignore Android and completely ignore WebOS and completely ignore BlackBerry and still make a phenomenal living, if not more.
Yeah, definitely. The iOS market is huge.
But if you're being hired by somebody, or the company you work for already is saying, we need to do this, or you just want to own the mobile space across the board, and I can think of a whole bunch of, you know, what you might call check-in apps that,
right.
You know, they have to have a client for every single device that could possibly have a GPS in it, then you've got to.
Right. I mean, you know, it depends a lot on what the product is that you're making. Like, if you're making something where you're trying to sell an app for money, and that's it, and you don't, like, if it's, I love this quote. I think I've even said it before on here. There's a quote from Bill Gates in his book, The Road Ahead. I think it's The Road Ahead, from like 1993 or something.
Right.
And there's a great quote. He was talking about the network effect and saying how certain products it matters and certain products it doesn't. And he said, a wonderful nonstick frying pan is useful even if you're the only person who ever buys one. And so, like, if you're making the kind of software, the kind of product where you're making something that's useful, doesn't need anyone else in the world to have it to be useful, and you want to sell it for money, iOS is, I think, the only place to do that, realistically. If you're making something that your main business model is getting tons of people to use this thing, like a social network or really any kind of like networky kind of thing, like eBay is a great example, like an auction place, you want as many people as possible to be there for everyone involved. So if that's the kind of play you're making with an app where you need everyone, then it's probably going to be free for one, or very, very cheap. But even then, like you need to be everywhere, as you said. Like you need to be on every client, you need to be on every OS, if that's the play you're going for. So, and in a client situation, obviously you have to ask them what they're going for. And similar to many client needs, they might be wrong. they might say, oh, well, we want to sell this app for $10, but we have to also have an Android version. Like, well, you're not going to sell an app for $10 on Android. but, you know, you can tell them that. They might say, well, I don't care, do it anyway, or we'll go somewhere else. So, you know, in the client world, you might not have the option to say no to them on something as major as this and still retain their business. So, again, the answer really is it depends. The way I address Android, which is actually the question here, the way I address the Android is that I just completely ignore it because I am in the business of selling an app for a non-trivial amount of money in the app space. It's $5. Like, it's not just 99 cents. It's $5. I'm selling this app for money. That is the bulk of the income of this business. And I'm better off ignoring that entire market of those people who wouldn't pay me money but who would help use the service. I'm better off not having them use the service because the service is not so network effect driven. Like, I have this social feature, the recommending things from friends. It's getting pretty good use already on iOS. I don't really need like that. It's not such a core feature of the app that I really need that to be pushed so hard that I would go to Android and make a free app with a bunch of ads all over it, like Angry Birds. You know, like it's not. That isn't the business I'm in, and so I can totally ignore Android and any other small and likely unprofitable market, or at least low profit market. Whereas, you know, somebody making like Instagram just said they're making an Android version. That makes sense. They've chosen, even though I said in an earlier episode that they didn't need to do this, whatever the issue, they chose to do like the big VC-backed free app, huge network effect social kind of play. And it's working for them. So, yeah, in that context, they need to be everywhere. They're probably going to have a webOS version next. Who cares? You know, once you add Android, why not add others? they should really do BlackBerry too. But, you know, it's... So, yeah, that's the answer is you got to really see what you're developing, and your clients might not give you a choice, but also you have a choice of which clients to take. And so if your business, like if it matters more to you to keep doing only the platform you like developing for, if you can find enough clients who need that work to be done to support your business and your financial needs, then that's a choice you can make. You can say, okay, I'm only going to do this. You know, no one's forcing you. If there's enough business on this side, you don't have to go to both sides. So I think that's about it. Yeah.
Yeah, I hear this all the time in developer circles is, of course we're starting with an iOS app. Of course. But should we do the other ones? And it reminds me of, I think it was at Future of Web Apps about a year or two ago. And there were a whole bunch of iOS developers that were announcing new versions of their apps there that day. And I remember, I hope I'm not repeating myself because I know I've told this story before, but I would approach him and I would say, hey, what about Android or what about WebOS? Are you coming out with clients for either of those? And they all kind of had the same response. Of course, this was a year or so ago, but they were all kind of, well, iOS is really working for us right now. And that it seems your analogy, I think, to IE is a good one, but it seems easier to ignore, unless you have that mandate that you must create it or you must be in that space, it seems easier to completely ignore Android than it is to completely ignore IE. Because inevitably, IE users are going to go to your website. But if you don't create anything at all for Android, if you just ignore it, you're cutting off those people, but you're doing it decisively. Whereas with IE, you know they're still going to come and they're just going to have a horrible experience.
And to be fair also, like if you have an iOS app and an Android app, you can share almost no code between them. Whereas if you have... So an Android app is going to be like twice as much work. With a website, if you code using modern standards and modern techniques, and if you don't really need support for IE6 and maybe even IE7, if you can say like, all right, I'll support IE, you know, 7, 8, and 9 only, or 8 and 9 only, then coding a website to work in IE or to get like 90% of things looking right enough in IE, like you know, to get it good enough in IE, it is not anywhere near twice as much work.
Right.
Anyway, it used to be, but it's not, these days it isn't, right? You still have your common code base. Like having a whole separate app, unless you're going to use a cross-development framework, which we hate, there's lots of reasons why those are terrible, but that's another show. Unless you're going to use one of those, it's going to be a lot more work for each new platform that you add.
Right.
And you know, it's much more so than in the old world of getting IE to work. And so it's probably, and by the way, I mean, what you said just now, that's definitely the case. I get so many people asking me, hey, that's you this time.
Yeah, it's my turn this time. Now I have a phone. Well, it's not really mine. It's Damon. I'm in Damon's office in his extra room.
Hi, Damon.
He's not here.
Oh, he's calling maybe.
Maybe he is calling.
Maybe he has a question about Android development. So, I get people asking me all the time if I know anybody who can, any good contractors to develop their iPhone app or iPad app. There is such massive demand for good contract work in iPhone and iPad. It's crazy. You could do just that if you are good enough to ship something moderately acceptable in iOS, I'm confident there's enough business for you. The question is whether they'll find you and that, but there is so much demand for this. And it's not easy to make a good iOS app. It's easy to make a crappy one, but it's not easy to make a good one. And so there's very, very few people and firms who do. And if you can get into that market, which I think you probably can, you know, if you have any talent and if you care about the work at all, you can probably do this if you set your mind to it. Like, you can probably do it. There is so much business there. So again, it's what kind of consultancy do you want to be and do you need to be? And yeah, I think it's very, very likely that if you want to stay iOS only, you can. And yeah, you might lose a big client or two, but I think there's enough work you can make it work. But again, I'm not in the client services business, so all of this is speculation. With the one exception that I do get tons and tons of people asking me for good consultants. I never have enough to tell them. I can tell them like five names that are all booked solid for the next 10 years. no one has enough time to address all the work people keep asking me to help them with.
Right. Would you ever consider doing that again? Going out there and doing consulting work?
No, never. Now I've been bitten by the product bug, which is when you're doing consulting work, unless you have a piece of the pie, you can only ever make as much money as hours that you work. Like your income is capped effectively, and so it in some way it actually discourages attention to detail and quality, because like you're not really going to make any more money if you make this thing really great, as opposed to if you just make it good. And some people have good enough work, I think, that they just make it great anyway. But for the most part, there's the motivation to make it great is not always there. And the clients often don't want to pay for it to be great. They want to pay for it to just be good enough. So that kind of drives me crazy. And also just like the idea of not being able to make what I want to make, to have someone tell me what to make and I just have to do it. It's a great place to go and to start if you just like coding and you don't really have the urge to work on your own ideas very often, then it's a fine business to be in. Or if you're trying to become a product company and you just need funding to pay the bills until you have a product that takes off, a lot of people argue that this is a bad idea to try to do, but I think you can do it. I mean, that's how Tumblr was started. That's how a lot of things were started.
Right,
I mean,
sure.
37 Signals, Instapaper. It's a lot of things were started that way. So I think you know, consulting is a fine business. As I said, you know, if you're the kind of person to do it, that's fine. A lot of people do it for the wrong reasons, though. Like a lot of people do it because they think that's all they can do to make money, but they really, really hate it. People like me who like really want to be making their own thing, and so I could never do it for that reason. And also, I just the idea that I only make money when I'm actually working. That's very limiting. Like it makes it causes weird incentives. Like it encourages you to overwork. It encourages you not to take vacations and to maybe take on too much work from clients that you can't really handle. In geek terms, it doesn't scale very well. If you have a product, on the other hand, it scales a lot better. I mean, it doesn't scale perfectly. You still have things like escalating support costs. But like, I can take a vacation for a week. Next week, I'm going to be at a conference for a week. That's kind of a vacation. I'm going to be at a conference for a week. So if I was a consultant, that's like a week's worth of hours that I can't bill to anybody. But I'm still going to do just fine. I'm not going to lose a bunch of money by not working for a week. So it's a different world completely. And you know, if you don't care a lot about money. I mean, I'll tell you a secret. I do care a lot about money. If you don't care a lot about money, then maybe those pressures don't apply to you. But like for me, like when I was in the very brief time I was doing consulting work, like 3 years ago, I was always like, oh man, I got to take on more work. I would take on work I didn't like. I would take on more hours for projects that I just wanted to get out of, but I couldn't turn down the money.
Right.
And so I was not happy. I would get all, and then I wouldn't even want to do the work once I signed up for it. Like then I'd be like, I would treat it like homework, which I've never been very good at. I just would not be able to motivate myself. It was like the hardest thing in the world to get myself to start working on something I didn't want to be working on. So it's a very long-winded answer to say, no, I would never do client work if I could help it. But again,
we could do a whole topic about that.
I think we just did.
Well, I mean, I think it could be more because I have a lot of questions on that. But we kind of are out of time.
Yeah. Yeah.
But next
week for people, we're gonna see if it can work.
We'll do our very very best because Marco is going to WWDC in San Francisco. He will be there. We're going to try to record the day after the keynote, right? The day after it all starts. That's our goal.
Yeah, Tuesday.
So for those of you who are wondering that is the answer. We're going to do our very best to have a show. And worst case scenario, we'll do something. We'll make something happen. Something exciting and wonderful will happen.
Oh, definitely.
So we'll figure it out. But thanks for the great show. This is a great show this week.
Thanks.
Don't you get that vibe? Like, well, some weeks you feel it, other weeks it's not like you don't feel it, but you can tell when it was a good. This was a good one.
Yeah. Sometimes I think like kind of didn't hit it today, but yeah, this week I think this was pretty good. I like this one.
Well, thanks to iStockPhoto.com and MailChimp.com for making this possible. If you go to iStockPhoto.com/5x5, that's where you can get that discount and just go to MailChimp.com. Thanks very much to them. Thanks very much to you guys for listening. You can check out other shows that we do at 5x5, like Hypercritical and The Talk Show, which Marco referenced in today's show. And, you know, there's something I'm hesitant to do this. I'm hesitant to mention this, but I got an email that was pretty compelling. So I'm going to do this. I feel like a heel. Do you think you know what I'm talking about?
No.
All right. I've never done this before. The 5x5 is almost 2 years old, more than a year and a half old. I've never really talked about this, but I'm going to really do it now because I got an email from a guy and he said, Dan, I just found your donate page on 5x5, and all this time I've been thinking I'd love to help you guys out.
One?
Yes,
I didn't even know that
we have a donations page. So if people enjoy the shows and they want, I'm not asking you to do anything. But if you've been wanting to help out and support us, support the move to Austin, whatever you feel, you can go there and do whatever you want. That's all. I've said enough. I'm going to edit this out.
You gotta you make Merlin keep all of his stuff. You gotta keep this.
I'm gonna edit this out.
No.
There is a donation page if you want to go to 5x5.tv. There's a little donate link up at the top. But you don't go there. You don't have to go. All right. So we will be back next week for WWDC.
Yeah.
Thanks, Marco.
All right. See you.